All right. Well, we have been going through the fifth way, and we're just about done. I know I keep saying that, but I really mean it this time. One of the things that we've been doing as we finish up the book and finish up all the concepts there is to realize that we really need to know the shape of this journey. We really need to know the shape of this way, Jesus' way, the only way to the Father. Because if we don't know the shape, then we're always going to be moving in different directions. You know, we're going to be digging holes that are missing the sweet spot where the treasure is. And so what we've been trying to do is really define, what is this way? Now, obviously, we've been doing that for weeks and months here, but this is where we're trying to bring all the threads together. It's kind of like holding onto a bunch of balloons. We've got all the ribbons. We've got all the threads here. All the details are up there, but we want to get right down to the core and see if we can really understand what it is that Jesus is trying to do, because he is working so hard in the New Testament. I mean, if you read the red letters, he's working so hard trying to get us to understand, using every story, metaphor, parable, every literary trick in the book to try to get us to understand that what we think we're about is not it. You know, the way that we normally go about this life is not going to get us where we want to go. If where we want to go is to unseen Father, if that's where we want to go, what Jesus calls kingdom, that quality of life that we can have in the presence of this unseen Father, then we're going to have to go about it in a completely different way. And I want you to think for a minute. How much do you think that fear shapes your life? Think about that for a second. How much does fear shape your life? Now, you might say off the top of your head, well, I'm not afraid. You know, I go through my life not afraid. You know, but how much do you worry, especially on the religious front, of being led into error? How much do you worry about making mistakes? Not just religiously, but just in general. How afraid are you of making mistakes? How much do you think about what other people think of you? How much do you worry about being embarrassed, looking stupid? You know, when I did theater in high school, the drama coach, I'll never forget him telling us this. If you walk on stage and think you're going to look stupid, you will. That's that idea of self-fulfilling prophecy. You're so worried about looking stupid. You don't like your costume. You're afraid you don't know your lines. If you walk on with that kind of attitude, it's exactly what you're going to project. But if you just walk on like you own the place, even if you make a mistake, it's going to be all right. You know? How much do you think about these things? You know? How much do you worry about not measuring up? About not getting what you think that you deserve or think that you or what you just need? How much do you worry about losing out? About not getting what other people have? See, all these things are fears. How much does that shape your daily life? How much does it shape your reality? Have you ever tried to win someone back by making them jealous? You ever done that in a relationship? Can't say that I've ever done it. Someone did it to me once, though. You know? But think, if you do that, you know, if you're trying to get this person back, so you go with this person and you try to make them jealous with the other person, even if you get them back, what have you really won? What have you got? Codependent relationship. Bravo. You know, if it's based in fear, if you're using fear to bring something up, then fear is all that it's ever going to generate. That's the thing that we forget. Fear generates fear. I ran across a little blog entry that I thought was pretty cool. And this is, the name of the blog was to live in, the name of the blog entry was to live an epic life, embrace epic failure. I thought that was pretty good. The guy looks like he's probably in his 50s, but he starts out by quoting a 20-something blogger who writes, "I fear failure like a deer fears the lion." Interesting. Almost sounds like a psalm. The anti-psalm. "I fear failure like a deer fears a lion because while I don't mind the chase now, I know I'll ultimately tire. Truthfully, I don't trust myself not to trade my dreams for stability as age creeps up on me." That's a pretty insightful little bit, isn't it? This is a kid who's got some insight into the fear that's driving his life. Now the other guy writes, "How about you? Do you trust yourself not to trade in your dreams for stability? When I was younger, I swore to myself that I'd never compromise on my dreams. I vowed to not encumber my dreams with the complications of lifestyle and financial obligations. As I get older, I'm feeling like a salmon swimming upstream. My peers are preoccupied with risk management strategies. Oh, that's a good one. How do I make peace with the idea of greater risk? What if I fail? What if it's not just a small failure, but an epic failure? But then, how do we learn anything if not by failing? We learn to walk by falling over hundreds of times. We learn to talk by mangling grammar. My daughter crashed our car within a month of learning to drive solo. Yet years later, she's a good driver. Derek Silver says, when you're green, you grow. When you're ripe, you rot. If you're not failing, you're not learning. To learn effectively, you must make mistakes and learn from them. A muscle only grows if you work it till it begins to fail. So many of us live scared of failure, yet we lose sight of all the simple ways we've failed in life and grown in the process. It's the pattern that nature follows. Savas Dimopoulos, one of the lead scientists on the CERN project in Switzerland, you know, the big collider, made an observation that has stuck with me ever since. He said, jumping from failure to failure with undiminished enthusiasm is the secret of success. Think about that for a second. Jumping from failure to failure with undiminished enthusiasm. Boy, if you could live your life like that, what would it be like? If you could really do that. And Mary Douglas, who's a famous anthropologist, she asks, what will you do with your one wild and precious life? I love that. What will you do with your one wild and precious life? See, most of us live in such fear and we don't even recognize the fear as such. We live in anxiety, we live in stress, we live with worry, we live with all those fears that we just talked about, and we don't realize how much it's shaping us. But fear breeds fear, never love, never freedom. To be in fear is to be enslaved by all the things that we worry about. And it will never bring the abundant life that Jesus is talking about. The end result of Jesus' way is freedom. Freedom from the fear that debilitates. Freedom from the fear that keeps us in that defensive crouch. Keeps us at arm's length from each other. Keeps us from being able to ever be present to anyone or God himself in this moment. Like we said last week, the means that we use must match the ends that we seek. They must. If we are going for the perfect love of an unseen Father, then we need to start practicing that perfect love as the means to that end. Because if we do anything less, if we live in fear, then the fear is only going to breed more fear. It will never take us where we want to go. And Jesus is standing here in those red letters, and he's telling us over and over again, you got to sell everything that you own. Give it to the poor and come follow me. You have to get out of this vehicle that will never take you where you want to go and get into this vehicle over here, which has a chance of doing exactly that. This is what Jesus is talking about. There's a quantum leap that we've got to take. There's a leap that we've got to make before we're ever going to be able to get there. If we seek the unseen Father of Jesus, then we must travel this unseen way of Jesus. Jesus said it was the only way. Look at John 14:6. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. You're not going to get to an unseen Father if you're using a visible path, if you use a path that you've always used, that's familiar to you, that includes the fear that you live by. If you want to get to an unseen, unlimited, abundant, unconditional Father and love, then you need to start practicing walking basically on air. Faith speaking, following this unseen path. Because if the Father is unseen, then the path, the way to the Father, has to be unseen as well. And we've got to make this shift, you know? But this is where we get scared. It's just too radical. It's just too much. But the Father's love is too radical and too much. It's too much for us to get our head around, to get our arms around. We don't quite trust it. It's just too good to be true. And so we stay in our place of fear. We stay in our safe defensive crouch. We stay behind our walls. And we never can experience what Jesus is talking about. We want that path laid neatly out in front of us, don't we? Isn't that what we want to do? Think about it. What's the difference between a coloring book and a sketch pad? Just a bunch of blank pages. Think about that for a second. What's the difference in the product if you go through that coloring book or you go through the sketch pad. See, the lines are all drawn for you in the coloring book. You color them in. You modify them somewhat. You know, you get your little bit of choices in the colors and everything. But if you stay within those lines, what you will get is what was prescribed for you. What you get is what somebody else designed for you. But if you're a writer, you know the scariest thing in the world is a blank page before you write that first word. But to have a blank page, to have a book of blank pages, means that anything is possible. Anything can happen. If we stay only inside the lines, we will never go into that unseen world. If we stay on the familiar path, the one that is beaten, the one that we know, then we're never going to get someplace that we've never been before. Now, this is an honest mistake that we make, if you think about it. Because if you look back into your past and you look at the path that you've taken, it's all bright and shiny and all laid out for you, kind of like flagstones in a lawn, you know, or footprints on a beach. You can see exactly where you've been. And you look back and you see that one path, that one straight line, you know, that's all the choices that you make. And so when you look forward, you imagine that there's supposed to be a path just as neat and just as straight and just as brightly lit going forward. And you can call it God's will. You can call it God's plan. You can call it destiny. You can call it fate. You can call it chocolate fudge sundae. It really doesn't matter. But what you're imagining is that there is this path all laid out for you. But that's not the way life works, is it? We spend our whole lives trying to delineate the path before we negotiate it. But the truth is, moving through life is much less like walking through a path in the woods and much more like a ship at sea. Because in the ship at sea, you can look back and you can see your wake. You can see where you've been, and there's a track there for a while. But when you look forward, it's nothing but a trackless expanse of water. Until you pass through it and cut your wake in it, there is no path. And really, each moment is like that, isn't it? There's no path. There's just a cloud of possible futures, if you want to think of it that way. Your moment includes a choice. Of all of those possible choices you can make, you make one. And that moves you into the next moment, which gives you another cloud of possible choices, possible futures. And with each moment and each choice you make, now you can look back and see a path, but not in front of you. It's open. It's unseen. The truth of the matter is that the seen path, the visible path that we so yearn for because we're so afraid, is an illusion. There is no path until we step on it. What's that quote by Chuang Tzu, the next one in there, you know? A path is made by walking on it. That's the way life works. We're looking for the risk management solution. We're looking for a way to limit our mistakes. But the truth of the matter is we just need to move out. Make the mistakes. You know? It's all not laid out. This is where we got to try to go. When I was in high school, I played football. Now imagine me trying to play football. It was pretty comical. I rode the bench for the most part, but I was stalwart for 2 years riding the bench in football. But I remember the first time that I got called out to play. I was a split end because at least I was fast. I got called out to play in a scrimmage, and the play was for me. Go and get in the huddle, and it was like a split end around. So I would take one step forward, plant, spin around, come back, get the ball from the quarterback, and then hit the line. And I knew all the plays. See, I can do that. I can study. I can learn things. I can memorize stuff. And I had that playbook down. I knew exactly what I was supposed to do. I was still scared, but I got up there, took the snap. I spun around, came, and here comes the ball, you know, slapping my chest. I take it, I turn, I cut toward the line, and then I panicked. There was no more play. What the heck do I do now? No one's telling me what to do now, you know? I'm just running. And I was scared, so scared. Bam, right into the biggest linebacker you ever saw. You know, zero gain. Here's the thing. We all do exactly the same thing. We want to know the play. God, give me the plays. But there's a point at which the play runs out. The play starts the process in motion. But the game really begins when the play runs out. Why do you go to a football game in the first place? Not just to watch the play. You go to the game to watch what the players do when there's no more play. That's the unknown. That's the exciting part. That's where the talent really shows. When you can just, in split second, make your choices and move. I couldn't do that in football. You know? And I was scared because the play was over. Just like when high school was over. There was no more high school to hold me in place, to give me a path, and I was scared, and I had to make a choice, and I didn't know what to do. So many of us are in this position. We panic because we can't see the path. And how do we imagine this path? You know, what the book is all about is called The Fifth Way. And if you want to know what the fifth way is, you first have to know what the first four ways are. And what I noticed as I was studying first century Hebrew history is that there were four basic sects, S-E-C-T-S, four basic philosophies, as Josephus called them. And they were the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the Zealots and the Essenes. And each one of them had a characteristic way of creating their path, of dealing with the obstacles and the challenges that stood in their way. For the Sadducees, who were the consummate insiders, they were the ones who yielded to the power in their path. They just glommed onto it and took off for a ride. And they would compromise anything they needed to in order to grab onto the power du jour. So they yielded. The Pharisees were the ones who were the influencers. They were the conservatives of their day, trying to hold the line on Jewish culture as it was being just obliterated by Greek and Roman influences. And so they were the ones who were manipulating. They were the ones who were influencing. And then they were the Essenes. They were the ones who went out into the desert and said, you know, you guys are all so screwed up, we're just out of here. So we're going to go create our own pure community in the desert, at Qumran, by the Dead Sea, and other places. And we're going to wait till you blow yourselves up, and then we're going to come back in and take over the land. So their strategy was to exit. And then finally the Zealots, they were the guerrillas of their day. And so their choice was to destroy. And as I looked at those four sects and how they operated, what I realized is those were the sum of all the choices that any of us as individuals or as groups have to deal with the things that we need to acquire in life and the challenges that we're going to face. Right? We can yield. Think about a marriage. You got a difficult spouse, you know, very domineering, abusive spouse or whatever. You can yield to that. You can try to manipulate it or influence it. You can just get the heck out, or you can destroy back. You can fight back. But whether it's in marriages or whether it's in groups or families or whatever, those form that compass rose, north, south, east, and west. All of the ways that we as human beings can deal with the problems in our life, at least physical ones across the face of the earth. But here comes Jesus and said, if you want to get to the Father, this unseen Father, if you want to live in kingdom, then you're going to have to use a completely different way. This fifth way that comes from a completely different angle. Not one that's on the plane of the surface of the earth, but it comes straight out of heaven. And it takes everything that you think you know about how you deal with life and turns it upside down and inside out and backside front. And everything you think you know has to be put into question. And everything that you think you have has to be laid down so that you can negotiate this new way. Because the truth of the matter is, this unseen way to Father is not about acquisition at all. It's not about going out and acquiring things. It's about laying down the things that you're carrying around that are obscuring the truth from your eyes. That everything that you have is already right here, right now, within, as Jesus said. This is the truth. We imagine the ways of spirit are the same as the ways of physical acquisition, and Jesus is trying to tell us that they're not. They're completely different. I wanted to read just a little bit, see if this helps from the fifth way. If you're on a recognizable path, a familiar path, you're most likely not on the fifth way, but one of the other four. Like the rich young man, you've crept back from the edge of the familiar in fear of too much unseen space. No need for shame. We all do this. If Yeshua's way really does bring us back to Father, then it also brings us radically beyond everything we think we know, because that's where Father lives. We won't see the path stretching out before us, planned and understood. It doesn't do that, but remains eternally new and unanticipated, unsettling, disorienting, disturbing, dangerous, yet exhilarating, breathlessly materializing under our feet with each step. The line between the familiar and the unfamiliar, between the four ways and the fifth, between earth and heaven, is the edge from which Yeshua is calling us to fall if we really want to experience life that is eternally new. It will cost us everything we have, everything we've accrued and come to trust, everything that blinds us to the radical truth within, among, and in our midst. We try to follow codes. We try to follow practices. We try to follow feelings that we can understand. We talked about this in the last few weeks, this intellectual way. We want to try to understand, because if we can understand it, we imagine we have control over it. But it's the laying down of that intellectual bent. Not that it goes away, that we check our minds at the door, but we get a balance between the two. But we're not saved by the mind. It's an experiential journey. We want to imagine that it's a legal orientation. If we just follow the rules of the law, of morals, of ethics, then again, we have a contractual relationship with God. We do this, and God's obligated to do that, and here we go. Everything is good. We want an emotional way. If we can just feel God all the time, then we'll be okay. But what happens when we don't feel God? Does that mean the process is stopped? And last week we spent a lot of time on that. No, as long as we're showing up to the process, spiritual progress is being made whether we feel it or not. And then there's a religious. What do we do with that? So what Jesus is trying to get us to understand is that understanding and compliance and feelings as such can't get us to the unseen Father either. There's something more than that. There's something more that we're after. But what about religion? We haven't talked about that one yet. Religion's a little bit sneaky. Surely religion is going to take us to unseen Father, right? No, and don't call me Shirley. Religion is sneaky about this because it masquerades as spirituality. We think religion and spirituality are the same thing, but they're not. What is religion, after all? You know, if you think about it, what would be a good definition of religion? Well, what's that? Rules. That's pretty good. Anything else? Following doctrine. Okay. Anything else that religion is that right off the top of your head? Legalism. Okay. Methodology. Is that? Rituals. Good. Rituals, practice, doctrine, theology, legalism. Some of this stuff has a negative, sometimes a neutral. You know, some has positive, but it's the set of all of those. It's basically the culture of a people that are following a faith tradition. It's everything that they do, everything that they believe, everything that animates them. But here's the thing. If you roll the clock back on any religion, what you get to at the very beginning is usually one person who had an experience that was so intense and so deep that it changed their lives. And if that change was something that was attractive to other people, then they started glomming on. They started following. And as soon as you have three or more, you got a group. And as soon as you have a group, you got to have rules. You got to have some sort of order. You have to have some sort of way of doing things. I've said in here before, when people get together, there's only three things that we can really do. We can eat, we can sing songs, and we can tell stories. That's about it. That's what we do. You can dress it all up. You can do it different ways. You can do it with funny hats on. But the truth of the matter is, that's really all we're doing. But the order in which you do it, the way in which you do it, the words that you say, the things that you believe, are the expression of an experience. Do you see that? It was a spiritual experience that began, that changed a life, that began to change other lives. But that had to be expressed in a corporate way. That had to be expressed into the group. This is the way that we're going to follow each other. This is the way that we're going to do this. And so this expression of experience is what religion is. But when you join a religion, what do you get first? You get the cultural expression first, not the experience. Now, if the religion is doing what it's supposed to be doing, then what it's doing is that expression, that cultural set of rules and practices is funneling you and driving you down back to the original experience. That's what good religion is supposed to do, along with the fellowship and the accountability that keeps lives on track, that keeps people stable. But it's supposed to bring you back to that experience. Each adherent, each person should be able to experience for themselves that initial experience that began the whole thing. Otherwise, they're just sitting in a spot. They're accepting what other people have told them. They're building their walls around them to try to stave off their fears, but they're not taking this journey, this unseen path that will truly make them free of all of the fears that they have. So, this practice of religion is a guideline. It's a guideline to the experience, but we still have to take the journey. And the problem is that sometimes and oftentimes we see the religion as truth itself. We see the practice, the theology, the doctrine as truth itself and not pointing to a larger truth behind. And then we lose our way and we get stuck. It's just like the coloring book. If we just color inside the lines of religion, we're not going to be able to go where Jesus is trying to take us. So how do we move? How do we color outside the lines as we go? Well, the first thing we need to realize is that the lines drawn by religion, by law, by morality, by logic are not absolute. I don't know if that's tweaking any of you, that the law is not an absolute instrument, but it's not an absolute instrument. That's never the way that it was understood scripturally. Even as far back as Deuteronomy, the idea was to have the law written on your heart. It was something that was supposed to change you from the inside out. By funneling you through this experience, you learn things in the moments of connection that changed you. So you were no longer just following rules. You were becoming the law itself. You were changed by it. And so the principles of the law, the purpose of the law, was now just part of who you were. No longer just an obligation to follow. So pure experience can't be expressed. Not in words, not intellectually, not logically. It can only be pointed to symbolically. And there's a little quote here by Paul Tillich. And let's see, we've got that. What does he say? Man's ultimate concern must be expressed symbolically, because symbolic language alone is able to express the ultimate. See, the Bible's written this way. It's written to evoke an experience. It's written to break down the way that we're approaching something so that we can move and really find this God that we're looking for. It works much more like poetry than it does journalism. See, we want to read the Bible because we're Westerners. And we want this accurate stuff. We want to understand because we're bringing our intellect and our logic and all that to it. We want to read it the way we read the front page in the New York Times. As absolutely accurate. Which is probably a bad example these days. But if we can turn that around and see the Bible more as poetry, more as song lyrics, which are meant to bring us into a place, to evoke something, everything starts to change from that point on. And we can take a different tack. Look at Matthew 5:20. What is Jesus trying to tell us there? For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will in no way enter the kingdom. What was the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees? This absolute legalism, this absolute lawfulness, coloring inside the lines so fastidiously that they missed out on all the relationship that was happening in front of them. All they could see was compliance with the law. Coloring inside those lines. Jesus says you need to exceed that. You need to go outside the lines. You must exceed the playbook. The playbook that finally runs out. How do we get past that? This is where Jesus is trying to take us. This visible path that we so yearn to see in our fear. What do we end up doing when there's nobody there to tell us what to do? In those moments, alone, with each other, with God, what are we going to do then? See, religion tells us what to do, but then it becomes familiar, and we think it's truth itself, and we hunker down inside those walls, inside that familiar path, inside those lines. And then we start to fear everything that's outside, everyone that's outside. And how do we fear those people outside our own walls, our own tradition? By judging them, right? By trying to convert them, by attacking them, by debating with them, by shunning them. All these ways that we're expressing our fear because we really haven't taken the journey ourselves to be free from the fear. All we're doing is whistling past the graveyard. if we don't take the journey ourselves. Look at Matthew 5 at verse 43. You have heard it was said that you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Religion can often create an us and them type of mentality. We have the truth. We have the salvation. You don't. We're going to heaven. You're not. And so Jesus is trying to get us to break that down, to color outside those lines, to move from that very visible path to an unseen path that is so frightening for us. Because what do we fear more than our enemies? And who is our enemy anyway? Let me read a little bit more from the fifth way. Who's our enemy? Yeshua would say, anyone that we see as other, who doesn't think, act, or look as we do. From an irritating co-worker, to a legal adversary, to an unfaithful spouse, from someone in a different political party, ethnicity, or church, or theology, to an illegal immigrant, or the person who took your job. Enemy is the one who offends us through action or mere existence. The person we absolutely believe is going to hell. The thief, the addict, the pedophile, the child rapist, the suicide bomber. We fear our enemies, judge them into categories that strip them of the basic humanity we reserve for ourselves and those we understand and approve. Those who understand and approve us. Yeshua tells us that if we only love those who love us, what have we really accomplished? If we only are kind to those who are kind to us, what have we learned of his unfamiliar way? For Yeshua, loving the enemy, identification, and presence with another person, even in the absence of affirming feelings or understanding, is the central effect of radical transformation. Of being spiritually reborn with the ability to see the unity of eternal life everywhere we look. But if loving the enemy is the effect of being born again spiritually, what's the cause? In his typically paradoxical fashion, Yeshua is telling us in every way he can possibly think of that the effect is also the cause. That becoming unoffendable and unjudging, to place love where it is not deserved, leads both to and from the spiritual awakening of our second birth. Loving the enemy is the highest form of love that Jesus gives to us because it breaks outside the lines. It moves us past the playbook. It moves us off the visible path. The effect of Jesus' way, this unseen way, is freedom from fear. And there's nothing more fearful than our enemies. That's a place to start. That's why Jesus emphasizes it. When we can begin to see our enemies as ourselves, as one with us, then we can begin to love them and be completely present to our Father, our unseen Father right here and now, and everyone around us. One more excerpt. When Yeshua tells us not to resist an evil person, to offer our left cheek as well when struck on the right, to offer our coat as well when sued for our shirt, to walk a second mile of servitude when obligated only to go the first. He is telling us that being lawful and right is not enough. Being lawful and right is merely familiar, not godly or godlike. It does not show us the Father as Yeshua did with his fierce identification with the least of these. Being lawful and right is just a beginning, the barest beginning of a beginning. God is love. He doesn't do love as a verb. He is love as a noun. Our behavior means nothing to such a love. It just is. Exists as itself. Can't be attenuated or diverted in any way. Is never withheld. When Yeshua reminds us that sun and rain and the warmth and provision of the Father's love fall indiscriminately on both the just and the unjust, the righteous and unrighteous, if we're not offended and outraged, we haven't been paying attention, haven't moved, even within the vicinity of the Father's radical conclusion. Love that is earned or reciprocated is familiar. The Father's love is neither earned nor familiar, continues whether reciprocated or not. We can stand in shade and shelter, deny its existence, but we can't stop the falling. This is outrageous, unfair, unjust, isn't it? Exactly. God's love is not fair. God's love is not just. God's love deliberately unbalances the scales of justice in favor of the beloved, always in favor of the beloved. If we really want to follow Yeshua's way, the only way to the Father, we will have to pass through outrage and offense. Let our outrage at the furious nature of God's love burn until there is no fuel left within. Yeshua is telling us that nothing happens in the first mile, the familiar mile of obligation, of law and rule. It is in the second mile, the voluntary mile of undeserved love, that we learn something of our Father in heaven and ourselves here on earth. Loving our neighbor brings us to the edge of all we cling to in fear. Loving the enemy puts us in free fall. Love like this cannot be transferred. Too radical, too perfect. It must be experienced to be believed. When we feel the first stirrings of compassion leave our heart in the direction of someone we believed impossible to love, when that compassion allows us to lower justice and blood pressure long enough to give whatever is most needed in the moment, it's then we first glimpse the equally impossible love our Father has for us. We will never really believe we can be loved and accepted until we experience giving love and acceptance away to someone equally undeserving. If we can't love the enemy, we'll never know how God can love us. If we can't forgive the enemy, we'll never know how forgiven we really are. The only way we can freely give something away is if we already possess it in the first place. And the only way we know for sure whether we possess a thing is if we can freely give it away. No strings attached. We can only love because He first loved us. Are we willing to walk out on an unseen path? Are we willing to keep going after the play ends? To color outside the lines? To do things that are so frightening to us at first glance, but because Jesus is showing us, we take the risk and we experience something completely different? If we keep looking for the visible path, the path that we know, keep looking for some kind of path in the future, we're going to miss the fact that it's a trackless passage through the sea that Jesus is trying to guide us through by the choices we make each single moment. If we're not willing to do this, then we can't really follow Jesus and we'll never experience what He experienced. One last thing I want to read that is just so perfect, and actually my friend Jim over here reminded me of it last week. It was a prayer written by Sir Francis Drake, 16th century. Some of you may know of this one. But he wrote it just as he was leaving Portsmouth for what was going to be the second circumnavigation of the globe. And he writes, "Disturb us, Lord, when we are too pleased with ourselves, when our dreams have come true because we dreamed too little, when we arrive safely because we sailed too close to the shore. Disturb us, Lord, when with the abundance of things we possess, we have lost our thirst for the waters of life. Having fallen in love with life, we have ceased to dream of eternity. In our efforts to build a new earth, we have allowed our vision of the new heaven to dim. Disturb us, Lord, to dare more boldly, to venture on wilder seas. When storms will show your mastery, when losing sight of land, we shall find the stars. We ask you to push back the horizons of our hopes and to push back the future in strength, courage, hope, and love. And this we ask in the name of our captain, who is Jesus Christ." Let's pray. Father, you know this is not easy for us. And you know the source of our fears. You know the extent of our fears. And so we pray that you would help us to overcome them one by one in each moment. To find you, to find your model for us, to find your love for us that can overcome the fears to move outside the lines, to move off the visible path and find what waits for us, you waiting for us. Thank you, Father, for everything that you give us, every guide, every person in our lives, every moment that can teach us. We really want to be closer with you every single day. Help us. And thank you for loving us the way that you do. We can only love because you loved us first. In Jesus' name. Amen. Let's all stand.